talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. Today is January 25th. And we got lots of movie stuff to talk about today. We've been talking a lot about awards the past several weeks because it's that time of year.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to talk about awards today. Just kidding. Of course we're going to talk about awards.
Of course we are.
but they're probably not quite as much, maybe. What happened over the weekend at the box office, Michelle? Let's talk about the top 10.
Actually, there was a lot happening, especially with the blizzard up in the Northeast. So that kind of hit ticket sales over the weekend. So here are the official worldwide weekend box office estimates for the weekend of January 17th from our friends over at Rentrak. And number
Wait,
one.
Are they really our friends?
They are. Yeah, I get.
Do we know them on a first name basis?
It's one of them I do, actually.
Yeah. Okay.
We've got to do lunch sometime.
Yeah, exactly. At number one was The Revenant from 20th Century Fox that
right.
was playing over at 3,700 locations, and it came in at $16
million.
Mm. It proves to be a force to be reckoned with as the multiple Oscar nominee and Golden Globe winner takes the world by storm with $49.8 million this weekend.
Well, I must say it's doing well for what I kind of perceived when I first saw it as kind of an art house almost type film.
Exactly.
But it's really, it seems to be finding a wide audience. I'm
yep.
surprised.
Oh, sure. Well, you talk about The Revenant?
Yeah.
It's got Leo in it.
Well, yeah, but it's not, you know, it's not like a big, you know, sci-fi type of thing that you think would appeal to mass audience. It's a Western.
Well, it appeals to men. It appeals to action fans. It appeals to adventure fans.
I don't know. But it is doing better than I expected. So
at number two is Star Wars The Force Awakens. That brought in $14.3 million. It's reached $1.9
billion wow.
throughout the weekend. Mm. Yeah, so now it's headed towards the $2 billion club.
Wow. I think they'll get that before the end of February, probably, right?
The way it's going, could be.
Yeah.
Number three was Ride Along 2. Came in at $13 million, playing at 3,100 locations. Hmm. The audiences that really showed up for that last weekend that they were hoping for this weekend, where they were playing and where that was happening was primarily last weekend up in the Northeast. So Universal's kind of thinking that maybe the blizzard kept a lot of people home.
That's her excuse.
Yeah, for dropping two spots.
Couldn't be that it's a lousy movie.
No. Hey.
Could very well be. The word spread.
Yeah. And number four is Dirty Grandpa from Lionsgate, playing at 2,900 theaters. That came in at $11.5 million. Critics have not been kind to that film.
Well, they would. To the ones that got to see it.
Dirty Grandpa. Yeah, we didn't get to see it. Anybody in this room see it?
No.
I kind of want to see it. I think it looks funny, but I'm a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah, Variety was not kind to that film in the review.
I'm an Aubrey Plaza fan. I was wanting to see it. So
at number five was the horror film The Boy. Came in at a respectable $11.3 million.
Playing how much did it cost to make that movie? Probably not much more than that.
I don't think it, 2,600 sites. At number six is Sony's The Fifth Wave. Playing at 2,900 theaters, the film brought in for the weekend, its first weekend, $10.7
million. I bet they're pretty disappointed over at Sony about that, I would think.
Yeah, there's not going to.
Those young adult novel-based movies do a lot better than that, usually.
I like the trailer. It looked promising, so I don't know.
Jim saw it.
Yeah.
Jim's going to review it here in a minute.
Still doing really well. At number seven is 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. Paramount's movie brought in $9.8 million at 2,900 theaters. It had a decline of less than 40%. So for a Michael Bay film, I mean, that's pretty good. His recap of the response to the 2012 attack in Libya has hit $33.5 million in its first 10 days.
Okay.
So not bad.
It's a great movie.
Yeah. Very much so. Number eight is Daddy's Home, another movie from Paramount Pictures, $5.3 million. Number nine, Norm of the North, yikes, $4.1 million. I don't think we'll be seeing a sequel to that.
No.
The Producers Guild winner, The Big Short, was number 10, another film from Paramount Pictures with $3.5 million. It's made $56.7 million domestically to date, doing pretty well. Number 11 was Sisters, brought in $1.9 million, and rounding out the 12 was The Forest from Focus Features with $1.8 million.
Surprised it's still in the top 12, really.
Mm-hmm. So this weekend, what's going to knock it out? Oh, 50 Shades of Black. Kung Fu Panda 3 opens this week, and that'll probably do well.
That could be number one.
It's interesting, though, the first two Kung Fu Pandas open in the summer, and they're putting this one out in January.
Yeah, that's not, they don't have a lot of faith.
Not a good sign. I've seen it. I'll talk about it here in a little bit. Jane Got a Gun, is that open Friday?
Yeah.
They're supposed
Natalie,
to, yeah.
Is that Natalie Portman?
Entertainment Weekly has an interesting article about that. Did you check that out?
I did see that.
I didn't realize it had been sitting on the shelf for, I guess, nearly 2 years.
That's really what I was just going to say. Weinstein didn't quite know what to do with it. And
Well, this harkens back to last January with The Seventh Son. That was that was maybe 2 or 3 years old.
Yeah. Is it a crime film?
That's a Western.
It's a Western. You're kidding.
It almost sounds like a remake of Heine Coulter.
Oh, yeah.
That's the vibe I get, too.
With Raquel Welch and Jack Elam and Ernest Borgnine and Strother Martin. I love that movie.
Yeah, I guess Ewan McGregor is the head of the bad guys and the Robert Culp part from Heine Coulter is Joel Edgerton.
Yeah.
And from the article, it sounded like they were switching roles back and forth. For a while, Joel was the main bad guy, and then it was Ewan, and it was Jude Law for a time.
So let's start reviewing some of these darn movies. We've got a lot of movies to review, actually. Yeah. We got to do The Boy, Mojave, Son of Saul. Jim, why don't you start with Son of Saul?
Okay, Son of Saul is the lead contender at the Oscars for Best Foreign Film. It's been racking up Critics' Awards. I believe it got the Golden Globe a couple of weeks ago.
I think Goodnight Mommy's going to win the Oscars.
Well, if it were nominated, it might stand a chance.
Oh, it's not nominated?
It's not even nominated, no.
No.
Now, actually, I feel pretty good. I've seen three of the Best Foreign Film nominees now, so that's nice. And I think one of them is still playing here in town. I think Mustang is still somewhere, I think. I'm not sure. But this will start, I guess, at Plaza Frontenac on Friday. It is a Holocaust drama. It's set in the 40s in Hungary. And actually, this is the first, I guess, big winner. Maybe it's first Oscar nominee from the country of Hungary.
Yes.
It's directed by Laszlo Nemes. And it primarily stars Geza Rohrig as Saul, and he is I believe the film terms a Soder Commando, who is a Jewish camp member, a prisoner, who helps. He's in charge of facilitating all the things that they do at the camps.
Kind of a trustee.
Yeah, they sort of give him a jacket that has a big red X on the back of it that identifies him. And he's in charge of shuffling the new people in through the camps and into the quote-unquote showers. And taking care of their belongings, quote unquote.
What a pleasant gig!
Yeah, and he's kind of resigned to this. According to the prologue, the Soder Commandos do this. It sort of delays their time in the shower, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
They're surprised because somebody survives the showers. He's going through the bodies, or as the Germans call them, the pieces. They never refer to them as people or bodies or whatever. And he hears a coughing, and they find a young boy who's maybe about 8 or 9 years old who's somehow still alive. This affects Saul, the main character in the film. And even though the boy doesn't last too long, once one of the German facilitators find him, he decides that he's going to take this boy's body and give him a proper Jewish burial. For the brunt of the film, he's going about trying to find a rabbi that will help him do the ceremony and conduct the ceremony. And he's concerned with trying to hide the body from the ovens, from being disposed of, and trying to locate some rabbi that'll do this. Now, what's interesting about the film, the way it's shot, it's almost in sort of a square in the center of a screen. I don't know if you recall the film, I believe it was called Mommy last year from Xavier Dolan, where it sort of looked like you were looking at everything through an 8x10 photographic frame.
And then it got wide at one point for a few minutes.
I don't believe it gets wide at any time. What's also interesting is the camera is pretty much, it's not a point of view from Saul, but you're over his shoulder and next to him, and you're just near him through the whole time, so that your point of vision is pretty much what he's seeing. So a lot of times you'll hear shots or screaming or shouting from off camera, and it'll take a moment for him to direct his focus to wherever the action's happening. It's a really gives the film an intimacy and an immediacy that is not usually that prevalent in a lot of films, period films like this. It's very well done. It's some of the scenes are just heartbreaking. It's really affecting. The performance by Roering is very good. This is a guy that's sort of been beaten down. When this boy is alive, you can almost see sort of a light get switched on in his mind, and he gets this idea in his head, maybe this is a way for him to take back his humanity somehow, to make him, you know, seem more than just a prisoner or an eventual piece to be shuffled around.
So why do you think it's the front runner for best foreign picture?
I think it's the unique way it's been shot. I think the story is very compelling and almost seems like it's in real time. It takes the place over a day or so.
And the Holocaust theme.
Yeah.
The Holocaust theme too is very good.
Trump's.
Yeah, I wonder how many Holocaust movies have won the best foreign language film.
Or usually they dominate the documentary categories, too. Yeah. But I think this one is a very good one. Now, the two others that I've seen in that category, Thebe and Embrace the Serpent, they're very good, too.
Yeah.
I would have a really tough time choosing. But
they're not Holocaust.
They're not Holocaust films, but they're very, very well done, and there's not a dull moment in either one of them. So, yeah, it's definitely worth seeing. I would recommend it. I think I'm probably going to give it, you know, at least 4, maybe 4.5 stars.
So.
Just a bit of trivia on what you had mentioned in your review about how the film was shot. The film was shot in the now unusual Academy aspect ratio, 1:37:1, to create the, like you said, portrait-like focus.
Yeah. Mm. And like I say, you're the camera, you're not just, you know, at Saul's back, you're roaming all about him so that you're just... He's the, you know, pretty much the focus of the film. I guess maybe he thinks that this boy could have been his son.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
mm-hmm.
That's another aspect of it. But yeah, it also involves a planned sort of fight back, an attack on the camp itself. And you're sitting there, you know that it's not going to work. But these guys are so adamant about it that you almost want to believe that they're going to have a shot at it. But it's pretty not dreary, but I would say, you know, it's some of it's tough to take, but it's worth viewing. It's very, very well done.
Hmm. Okay, so Jim recommends Son of Saul, and look for Jim's review of Son of Saul Thursday evening at weirdmoviegeeks.com. Damn Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Well, just like Indiana Jones Nazis.
There you go. All right, I look forward to seeing that movie. And I'm going to do a quick review of Kung Fu Panda 3. I'm the only one in the room who has seen it. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this. This is the third installment of The Adventures of Po, the Kung Fu-wielding panda voiced by Jack Black.
Who are you?
I'm looking for my son.
Dad?
Give your old man a hug!
How do we know he's even related to you?
Look at that!
Come with me. There's a secret panda village in the mountains.
Whoa.
Welcome home, son.
If you liked part one and part two, I guess you'll like part three. My biggest problem with Kung Fu Panda 3 is they have Jackie Chan and Seth Rogen and Angelina Jolie and Lucy Liu in their sort of Poe's sidekicks, but they're barely in this new movie. And they felt the need to introduce two major characters. One is Poe's long-lost father, who is voiced by Bryan Cranston. And, of course, when I think of kids' cartoons, I think of Bryan Cranston. I guess James Woods was busy. And then they've got a villain voiced by J.K. Simmons. So a lot of the footage is dedicated to these two new characters, which is too bad. I mean, why put Angelina Jolie and Jackie Chan in your movie if you're barely going to use them?
Well, is Dustin Hoffman still prominent in it?
Yeah, he's barely in it as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And it's, you know, it is funny. It's written by the same writers that wrote the first two, and Jack Black has a lot of funny business with his, you know, his constantly wanting to eat and a lot of jokes about that. And so there is a lot of good humor, and there's some some good fight scenes. If you want to watch cartoon animals do martial arts, that it delivers. My problem with it is it's a little too sentimental. That part two. Did anyone see part two?
Yeah, I did see part two. Yeah.
The original film and part two were both Oscar nominated films.
Was part two? I thought part two.
No, part two was.
Part two was all about Poe. Accepting the fact that he was adopted. So it was all about his adoption, and it got overly sentimental.
Oh no, it was an Oscar nominated film.
And then this part three, it gets real sentimental about his long lost father and his father taking him back to his village where he's from, where he meets all his cousins and things like that. And
it's a weird release date.
Now what's Kate Hudson in? Is she like a love interest?
Yes, exactly. She shows up in a part. Yeah. So instead of, I think it was a mistake to add all these new characters. I think they could have mined the existing characters, the established characters, for a lot more humor, because those are funny characters. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that seems to be the way with a lot of animated sequels, that instead of just, you know, getting back into the stories of the characters from the first film, they need to feel the need to put more and more in there.
Yeah, and again, you know, J.K. Simmons plays this villain, but this villain doesn't really fit in with the texture of the rest of the film. The villain looks like some beast out of like this new Warcraft movie or something like that. He doesn't seem to fit into the kid-friendly world of Kung Fu Panda. But it looks great. The animation's fantastic. It's DreamWorks. It's a beautiful film to look at. And I think if you like the first two a lot, you're going to like part three just fine. It's the weakest, but it's not a weak film. I'm sure it's better than Norm of the North or something like that, or the Chipmunks movie, which I reviewed last month. It's a good kids movie. I just think the this franchise is sort of a run out of new ideas, and maybe they should have sent it straight to DVD. Perhaps, I don't know. It's okay. It'll do well.
It's still visually striking, though. That's what I liked about the first one.
Yeah, right. So it's an okay film. I'm probably going to give it, I'm reviewing it. I'll probably give it, I don't know, 2.5, maybe 3. Three would be generous, but I think that's probably what I'll do. So, Kung Fu Panda 3 opens Friday. Another movie that opened Friday was The Fifth Wave.
At 1:07 a.m., the Odyssey satellite received images of an object moving past Mars.
It's right over us.
I want to see.
I didn't know it then. But that was the last normal day of my life.
We have reason to believe there's an imminent threat to this location.
All right, stay with your sister.
The waves have begun.
It started.
Coordinated attacks on metropolitan areas.
It didn't do very well. It only made $11 million, or a little less than that, actually. Jim reviewed it at WeirdMovieGeeks.com the other day and gave it 1.5 stars. Jim, what the heck is wrong with The Fifth Wave?
Well, it didn't do as well as the first four waves, but... this might be the last wave, I think. Mm-hmm. Wave goodbye to it, I should say. Okay. But, it's from Sony Pictures. It's another one of the endless rows of young adult novels that you see at your Barnes & Nobles and your bookstores and all that. And Hollywood seems to be mining them for hit films after the success of Twilight and Hunger Games. And, boy, does this owe a lot to both those films. But it throws in a lot of different elements into it that you've not seen before. It opens up with the hero, Cassie, who is played by Chloe Moritz Grace, Hit Girl from the Kick-Ass movies.
Carrie and Dark Shadows. She's sort of the young Scream Queen. She's made a lot of fantasy stuff and horror stuff.
I've heard she's going to be Ariel in a live-action remake of The Little Mermaid.
Oh, really? I did not hear that.
But she's trudging through a post-apocalyptic world, and it almost seems like she's in a episode of The Walking Dead, because she's scouring a convenience store for water or anything.
So it takes place in the future?
Yeah, it's not a distant future like the Hunger Games or something like that, but it's maybe like 5 or 6 years in the future. They do a flashback to her life beforehand. She was a high school student. She's got a couple of great parents played by Ron Livingston and Maggie Siff. And it's got a little kid brother named Sam, who's about 8 or 9 years old. And everything's going just really well for them. She's got a little crush on this this one dreamy boy who's played by the young man from Jurassic World.
Oh, he is some, dreamy.
Yeah, Robinson, I believe, is his last
name. Nick Robinson.
Nick Robinson, yes, yes. He plays Parrish, Bobby Parrish or something like that, mm-hmm. I think. So everything's going along great until those darn aliens show up.
Until that airplane falls out of the sky.
Yeah, well, it's because there's this huge, massive spaceship that doesn't look quite as big as the ships from Independence Day, but close. It starts hovering over the globe, and it's sort of circling the Earth, and the government's not doing anything about it because they're not sending out any message, and of course they're not responding to any messages that we're sending to that. They don't know what the spaceship is up to. And then finally, it attacks with the first wave, which is sort of a weird pulse, a magnetic pulse that it emits that knocks out the power, all the electrical power, all the batteries and all that. That's why you see the plane dropping out of the sky in the trailer. So that's the first wave. And, of course, that sort of puts everyone on a course to olden days, almost like, before electricity, and they're trying to get by. And, it's pretty rough. Cars won't work and everything. So that's the first wave. The second wave is an earthquake or a series of earthquakes that create these huge tidal waves. So I think in my review I said it looks like outtakes from or bonus feature stuff from San Andreas. It's got the big waves hitting New York, and they show I believe Tokyo and people scrambling and all.
But
that.
Is Alexandra Daddario in it?
No, she's not in it. And of course, Cassie and her brother have to outrun the cracking Earth at one point.
I love those scenes like that. Remember in 2012 when John Cusack was like driving and Earth was cracking behind him, and it went on and on and on.
Oh yes, yes.
I love that stuff.
So that's the second wave. The third wave is a souped-up super version of the avian flu. It's making people drop, lie, fly. So you've got Contagion here, lifted from that film. Cassie's mom is a nurse taking care of them, the people. And, of course, things don't work out well for her. So that goes to, I've got three waves so far. So the fourth wave is when the remaining members of Cassie's family go to a camp that's been set up in the wilderness. Suddenly, the military finally arrives, headed by Liev Schreiber. And for some reason, their trucks and everything are working. And they don't think, well, they must have figured out something with that. He informs them that the fourth wave is the little alien creatures, which look like little kid squids or something like that.
Oh, so you do see them.
So you see the Martians?
Well, you see what, they have like a little X-ray specs type of thing set up. So you can see the aliens inside the forehead of someone, and they've taken over their brains, and they say, well, we found a way to scan kids for this, people under 18, so we'll need them to get on the buses to go to the Air Force base. Meanwhile, the parents will need to remain here so we can do this more intense scanning. And of course, things don't work out. Cassie gets separated from Sam.
Of course.
Okay, let's cut to the chase.
What's so bad
about this movie?
It's as you can hear from what I've been saying, it's just throws in everything into it. They finally settle into this sort of twilight love triangle. It's almost like an Archie and Betty Veronica, or closer to Bella and Edward and Jacob. Between this guy that ends up rescuing Cassie and this other guy and this Parrish kid who's called Zombie, and it turns out he's being trained by the military. All the kids are being trained to go out and kill people that are infected with the aliens, and it's just throwing in everything but the kitchen sink. The brightest spot in the film is probably Makeup Monroe, who's a terrific young actress. You might recall her from last year's It Follows.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been kind of making a name for herself. She's playing a character called Ringer. All the kids that are being trained as soldiers have little nicknames. She's like a punk girl, and she's got this jet black hair and raccoon eyes, and she's kicking butt, not taking any guff from anybody, and she's having some fun with the role. And it looks like that maybe she's going to be a romantic interest for this this pair Parrish character, but never really pans out. Maybe they think that they'll follow through with it on a sequel, but doubtful if we'll see a sixth wave. Not likely after how poorly it did. It's a shame because I think Chloe Moretz Grace is a talented young actress, but she's got so little to do here. It's just not interesting. And there's even a scene, and I couldn't believe this. This fellow that ends up saving her, rescuing her. She's not sure of him, and they have to go on the run, and they're camping out in the wilderness. And she gets up that morning and notices that he's gone, and so she goes over to the creek, and there he is bathing. And we had a lovely dawn lit shot of his bare chest, and she's just going, and it's just so ridiculous. I wanted to throw my shoe at the
director. Is mostly a screenwriter, Jake Blakeson. I mean, he did The Disappearance of Alice Creed.
That was his only feature.
That was in 2009. So, and what's Leo Schreiber doing in this movie? Yeah,
what's Maria Bello
collecting
doing?
A paycheck.
Exactly,
their paycheck.
And Tobey Maguire is one of the producers of this thing.
That's why.
Toby, you should.
Upon sacrifice, they get together. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But it's just so silly. It verges on camp, but it's certainly not worthy of your time.
All right. So Jim does not recommend The Fifth Wave. Go to WeAreMovieGeeks.com and read Jim's review where he gave it 1.5 stars. I gave Mojave 3 stars. Mojave opened Friday at one theater, the AMC Chesterfield. And there's only like a noon show and a 3 p.m. show. The studio really dumped this thing.
Does it have a video on demand?
Yeah.
I don't know. It might. Yeah. I'm not sure. I didn't look that up.
Who are you?
No one in particular.
People come out to the desert, they get fallen upon by thieves. Jesus came out here. Which brings us to, what are you thinking about in the desert?
I'm thinking some guy just walked in pretending to be the devil.
But it's interesting, though. It was written and directed by William Monahan, who won the Oscar a few years ago for writing The Departed. And it stars Garrett Hedlund, Oscar Isaac, Mark Wahlberg, and Walton Goggins. So, those are four very hot actors right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
In a couple, I'd say Mark Wahlberg and Oscar Isaac are box office actors. So it's kind of interesting that they didn't try to sort of cash in on the star power of this film and give it a wider release. But it's not a particularly great film. It's okay. The Departed was a remake of a Chinese action gangster film, and so I think Monahan had sort of a something to hang his dialogue on, a really good plot. This one's a little plotless. It's a serial killer drama where Garrett Hedlund plays this movie producer named Tom, and he's introduced driving out to the desert with two big bottles of vodka, and you think he's going to kill himself. He's going to end his life out in the desert. So he's sitting around the campfire drinking his vodka, and this leather-clad stranger stumbles on his campsite with a rifle, and there's been a series of killings out in the desert. So this guy's the serial killer. His name's Jack. So Jack and Tom sit around the campfire for a good 25 minutes talking about life and existential thoughts about life and death and Jesus and Shakespeare and all this stuff, and they talk and talk and talk, and then Tom realizes that Jack is probably out to kill him, so they get into a fight, etc., etc. And in the ensuing chaos, an innocent person who happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time gets killed. So Garrett Hedlund is Tom, heads back to L.A., and Jack is sort of on his tail, unbeknownst to Tom. It's sort of like, it reminded me of Cape Fear a little bit, except he doesn't crawl under his Jeep and hang on, like they spoofed in The Simpsons. So then you've got Walton Goggins and Mark Wahlberg, or two of his movie producer pals, but it's kind of a bizarre way that they show the movie industry. Everybody's really vulgar and sneering and smoking and wearing sunglasses, and it doesn't seem like a look at the movie producer community as much as it does, some sort of crime community. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. It's sort of plotless and meandering. I did think that Oscar Isaac was quite good as the serial killer. A lot of charisma on that actor. The Garrett Hedlund, I wouldn't say, is very good. He sort of mumbles and sneers, and he always has a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and You know, he's got this shaggy hair, and he's all wrong. It's not a bad performance, but he just sort of comes at it in a poor direction, I think. Mark Wahlberg, I said in my review, phones in his performance, but that's not a criticism. He literally phones in his performance. He's in four scenes, and three of them, he's like talking on the phone. I think he was in, of course, The Departed, so maybe he just did this. It was not much more than an extended cameo. Maybe it was a favor to Monahan. I don't know. What else did Monahan do? Do we know?
Boy, I just know him from The Departed.
Yeah, okay. Maybe this is his first directing movie. I'm not sure. I should have looked that up before I started talking about it. It's okay. I can sort of see why the studio didn't have a whole lot of faith in it.
He also directed London Boulevard from 2010.
Okay, I've never heard of that one. Mm-hmm. I gave it three stars, which is maybe a little generous. Maybe 2.5 would have been more appropriate.
His last films he's written, screenplay, The Gambler with Mark Wahlberg.
Oh, that was really good.
Edge of Darkness with Mel Gibson, which I really liked.
That one too.
I really liked that one.
Okay.
Yeah, Body of Lies, Kingdom of Heaven.
So, if you want to see Mojave, you better hurry, because it's probably only going to be in town for a week. And like I said, it's only at noon and 3, so if you got a day job, you're out of luck. or go and look, and maybe it's on a pay-per-view. But I only recommend it if there's nothing else to see out there.
Maybe if you're a hardcore Oscar Isaacs fan.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, Jim, I'm going to send it back to you.
Oh, my.
You're going to talk now about Finest Hours.
What's this on the radio? Ship breaking up.
She's a T2 tanker, split right in half.
We got maybe 2-3 hours, and then we sink. Where you
are? Chief, pick yourself a crew, and you assist that ship. You hear?
That's why I signed up. Guess now's my chance.
A man in there don't know what he's doing. He's sending you out to die.
The Coast Guard, they say, you gotta go out. They don't say you gotta come back in.
Is that Disney?
That is Disney. Yeah. That is the Disney label there at the logo at the start of the film. It is from, I believe his name is Carl Gillespie, who was the director of Million Dollar Arm a couple of years ago for the Disney company. But he also did Fright Night, the remake of that. I guess his first film was Lars and the Real Girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I interviewed him.
Craig. I'm sorry.
He's Craig, Australian.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But this is, I can see why this is the Disney mold, or this is why it's that labeled a Disney film, because it's an inspirational, true life story. Even though a lot of folks might think it's a sequel or a follow up to The Perfect Storm, it is set in 1952. Mm-hmm. It mostly centers on a young man who works for the Coast Guard in a small town in Massachusetts, Bernie Weber. Webba. Played by Chris Pine, who we might know better as Captain Kirk from the Star Trek rebooted films. And as the film starts, you see him meeting his fiancée for the first time, who's played by Holiday Granger, and it's a real, cute little sequence. And then it flashes forward to when they're about to be engaged. It's really nasty. I think it's in November or December, and the storms are brewing out to sea. Then we switch to the Pemberton, which is an oil freighter out on maybe about 10 miles off the coast. The storm is so bad that Casey Affleck, who plays sort of the engineer who's watching over the running of the ships, he's wanting to slow things down. And finally, he loses communication with the captain, so he sends one of his guys, to actually run to the front of the ship to where the captain is. But it turns out there is no front of the ship. That's one of the best sequences in the film. He's running down the plankway, and then it just ends, and the Pemberton is actually just split right in two. The head of the ship goes down, but the other part is still afloat that has the engines. Casey's trying to jury rig some way to sort of steer onto the rocks. That's his only option. He thinks that they can survive. But a lot of the film is concerned with his arguments with the other crew members that believe that they should hit the lifeboats, which are not going to survive the stormy, choppy weather. Finally, there's another freighter that's having trouble, which is communicating with the Coast Guard. Somehow, the Pemberton shows up on the radar there, which is closer to where Chris Pine's, Coast Guard outpost is. And so he's sent out on a small boat, and it's he and three or four guys, and it's all about him trying to navigate the waves there. Meanwhile, his fiance is all fretting about what's going on, so they're cutting back and forth to her. And then there's the whole, you know, thing on the remaining part of the ship itself with Casey and the crew there. It's okay. It's an okay film. It's I don't know. It just seems like it's wanting to be all things at once. It's wanting to be this sort of little romantic thing about, you know, Chris Pine's character and his fiance. It's wanting to be about the guys, you know, a survival's tale of the guys on the oil freighter. And then there's Chris Pine on the little tiny boat that's trying to, you know, go through these waves. And it's just, you know, constantly people getting doused with water with the boat going underwater. And it gets really tiresome after a while. You know, it's if it were, you know, just concentrated on one of the stories, I think it might have been a little better. But maybe you thought cutting back and forth would sort of
the pacing.
Ease up the pacing a little bit. It's certainly not as good as The Perfect Storm. Some of the sequence reminded me of the recent Heart of the Sea, which came out about a month ago.
Which was also in 3D.
Yeah, this 3D is not necessary for this film. It's it really doesn't anything except the little sprays of water and the rain and all that. And you're just watching it and you're just thinking about how freezing it must have been for these real life people,
So you're going to be reviewing miserable. Finest Hours Thursday night. How many stars are you going to give it?
Oh, I'm maybe going to give it 2.5 or 3.
All right. So Jim doesn't really recommend The Finest Hours. Okay, one other movie we got to review is The Boy, a new horror movie. Michelle and I saw The Boy Friday night.
And this is our son, Ross. Music gives him so much joy.
Brahms is not like other children. It is very important that you follow these rules. Be good to him and he'll be good to you.
Really liked it.
The Boy stars Lauren Cohan, and she plays an American in England who's trying to get away from an abusive relationship, so she takes a nanny job in this old stone mansion out in the British countryside.
It's modern times?
Yeah. And so she's employed by this older couple, and she's supposed to take care of their son, Brahms. So she shows up, and they say, here's Brahms. Well, Brahms is this doll who's maybe, 4 foot tall, and she finds out from the hunky grocer deliverer that
played by Rupert Evans.
Yes, that Brahms was their son who 20 years earlier had been killed in a fire. And so this old couple had never gotten over their son's death, so they have this doll that they call Brahms that they treat like a child and they take it very, very seriously. And this old couple is actually going to go on a trip, so they leave Laurie Cohen. Do you remember her character's name?
Greta,
okay. They leave Greta alone with Brahms for, an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. And mysterious things start happening. Brahms is moving around. She takes a shower, and Brahms takes her robe and her necklace, and all these creepy things start happening.
It becomes this waking nightmare, and she's like totally into it. She's totally going along with the whole thing.
Yeah, most people, I think, would have run screaming. You know, the first time Brahms is like laying on the bed, and then she walks out of the room, and the next minute he's sitting in a chair in a different part of the room. I think 99% of us would have run screaming at that point.
She's like, oh, wow, supernatural forces here at work, but I'm going to stay.
Yeah, which sounds bad, but it's not bad. It's actually pretty good.
It's really good.
It's you know what I liked about it is that it had a plot. I know that sounds like faint praise, but we reviewed a movie a couple of weeks ago called The Forest, which didn't really have a plot. It had a premise. There's a difference. You know, they set up a premise where this gal went out in this forest, but then they just started throwing things like, you know, these specters and, you know, these jump cuts and, you know, things going back and forth and things that... Oh, maybe they're not really there, that she's just seeing them. The Boy doesn't do that. The Boy actually has a plot from point A to point B to point C that you want to follow. You want to see what happens. You want to see what the twists and the turns are. And it does a pretty good job. It's well-paced. It's well-directed. It's well-acted by this Lauren Cohan gal who you may remember from The Walking Dead.
Yeah, so she's an American, so we don't hear her natural British accent
in this one.
Oh, that's too bad.
But she doesn't have the Southern accent like in The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
It's a really unconventional horror thriller from director William Brent Bell, who did The Devil Inside. I'm telling you that it keeps you guessing until the very end, until those final moments. So, and I liked Rupert Evans. I was like watching, like, where have we seen him? He was in Hellboy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it's got a twist, and the twist is a pretty good one. I didn't see it coming.
I didn't.
Yeah.
The producers on the film are Tom Rosenberg, who did Million Dollar Baby and Underworld. Gary Lucchese, who also did Million Dollar Baby and Underworld. Another producer who also worked on The Age of Adeline. And the music's by Bear McCreary, who does The Walking Dead and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh, okay.
So it's all around. It was a nice January surprise.
Yeah, this is a bit of a spoiler, but there's no supernatural elements in the film. Everything's sort of explained, which I sort of enjoy. The forest, again, just threw in these little, Japanese schoolgirls opening their mouths and screaming for no reason. This one actually doesn't underestimate the intelligence of the audience,
right.
I should say.
It's equally scary, though, even though when you do find the final reveal, it's still,
And there's a couple of jump cuts. There's a couple of dream scenes where, Brahms suddenly does something a doll can't do, but then she wakes up startled in bed. I think they do that, twice, or two or three times, maybe. Mm-hmm. And that's okay, because that had the audience screaming. We saw it with an audience Friday night, and everybody was screaming. It was a sold-out audience.
I watched it through, my usual slotted fingers.
So, I'd probably give it 3 or 3.5. I'd probably give it 3.5 if I were to review it, but it did not get reviewed at WeAreMovieGeeks.com because they did not show it to us.
Which is a shame.
Yeah. So we had to go see. We had to go pay money to see it.
Have some guts, studios, will you?
Yeah.
But then again, you guys get the forest.
Got the forest, which was like one star. Which was much worse. All right, so Michelle and I both recommend The Boy. All right, what else can we talk about? How about the PGA Awards, Producer Guild Awards?
Yeah,
there was something of an upset, right? Michelle, why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, Saturday night, they announced the Producers Guild Awards for 2016, and the Daryl F. Zanuck Award for Outstanding Producer, Theatrical Motion Pictures, went to, surprisingly, The Big Short. If the producing team should win, this is the same producing team, Brad Pitt, Dede Gardner and Jeremy Kleiner, who won 12 Years a Slave a few years ago. And it is also the first time 21 years ago Forrest Gump won and then went on to win Best Picture. So for Paramount Pictures, this is a pretty big deal. That would be my vote for come Oscar time, but we'll see.
Your vote or your prediction?
My prediction.
Okay,
my prediction
that's
and
different
vote.
Than vote. Oh,
but
you'd vote for that over The Martian if you had a Oscar ballot?
If I had a ballot, I'd go with, The Martian, but I'm thinking this
prediction.
We'll see what the DGA does coming up soon and the SAG. Yeah, The Big Short one, and then the Outstanding Producer of Animated Theatrical Motion Pictures went to Inside Out.
Uh-huh.
But the documentary went to Amy.
Okay.
No big surprise.
Yeah, no big surprises there.
Neither of those. Those are kind of Oscar shoe wins, I think.
But Oscar predictor extraordinaire Scott Feinberg over at The Hollywood Reporter has a really good analysis piece on why it's the front runner now. Adam McKay's film about America's recent financial crisis, he says, is the film to beat. The fact that 19 of the last 26 Best Picture Oscar winners first won the PGA Award.
You think they gave the Oscar to Adam McKay, though, for directing?
We'll see what the DGA does, what the Directors Guild.
I don't know. Well, like I say, when 12 Years a Slave won, it sort of tied at the PGAs with Gravity. Yeah,
correct.
Yeah. And they've been on the mark for the last 10 years, but before that, you've got films like Little Miss Sunshine and Brokeback Mountain. I think they picked Saving Private Ryan over Shakespeare in Love. So they're not 100%.
Scott Feinberg also mentioned in his piece that the number of PGA voters and the number of Oscar voters is almost exactly the same at about 7,000. And the PGA Awards are one of the few award groups that conducts voting using that same quirky preferential balloting system as the Academy does. So we'll see.
So Michelle's predicting a Big Short upset at the Oscars. What do you think is going to win Best Picture to the Oscars, Jim?
What I predict, I still think it could. I think it could very well be Spotlight
or
Revenant.
Yeah, because Revenant leads the field for Oscar nominations.
Yeah. But if I were voting, I'd vote for Spotlight or Mad Max. So.
I think Spotlight may have been the front runner a month ago. I think it's sort of losing a bit of steam. It did real well with the Critics Awards. But you got to keep in mind the Critics Awards are made up of journalists, and it's a movie that made journalists look really good. The Academy voters more artisans and technicians,
and they're voting for their friends.
I still think it's gonna be Mad Max. So Michelle thinks it's gonna be Big Short. Jim thinks it's gonna be a Spotlight. I think it's gonna be Mad Max, and the front runner is The Revenant. So it could go a number of ways.
This race is not over by any means, which is great because the last few years it has been.
Yeah, it's weird that the Best Picture could be the wildest race of all of the the major categories. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow,
interesting. So when is this DGA Awards?
SAG Awards come up before the Directors Guild.
SAG is this Saturday, I believe.
Yeah. I believe, and it's Sunday.
Sunday.
And it's like on TNT.
Yeah, yeah. So.
And it's a quick show.
So yeah, it would be nice if they streamed it. I don't think they are, but if you don't got the cable, you're out of luck.
Oscars.
Yeah,
Chris Rock
Oscars.
Is the host, and I hear they're trying to get a bunch of black presenters. Is that true? Oprah. But it won't, Will Smith won't be a presenter because he didn't get nominated, so he and his wife are taking their toys and going home.
After no African Americans were nominated in any of the acting categories when the nominations for the 88th Oscars were announced on January 14th, some in the film industry and press were outraged by the noticeable omissions. The perceived oversights of, for example, Idris Elba, Michael B. Jordan, the cast of Straight Outta Compton were just too much to be overlooked. This was the second year in a row that the nominees in all the four major acting categories were all white. So boycotts to the ceremony have been reportedly called for by the Hollywood elite, as well as changing to the voting and makeup of the Academy. Even the hashtag OscarSoWhite started trending. On Friday, People Magazine tweeted out a photo of a cover they did from 1996 titled Hollywood Blackout, with actors on the cover like Denzel Washington, Lawrence Fishburne.
Denzel Washington, who's won two Oscars, by the way.
But at the time, that year, the Oscars had only one black nominee out of 166. So, in a historic move, the Academy, after getting all this guff, they took action and they sent out a press release, and they made all these kind of changes, all these kind of voting changes, and the makeup of the Academy.
I think it's ridiculous, but I think it'll help the ratings, you know, because it's because it's going to be hosted by Chris Rock, and everybody knows he's going to make jokes about this controversy,
and
everybody's
going
to tune in to see what he has to say. I think it's a ginned up controversy, and I think
Michael
Caine,
there was
opinion.
There were a few actors who did come out,
and Charlotte Rampling.
Yeah.
And she got some heat. She could say goodbye to her chances.
I don't know if you saw Saturday Night Live this weekend. They did a very funny sketch about this. I highly recommend looking that up online.
Yeah, it'll be on you. It's on YouTube.
We'll be talking more about the Oscars. Oh, speaking of the Oscars, I will be hosting the Oscars at the Tivoli, which is the biggest Oscar party in St. Louis. Biggest and best. And Michelle will be at the Oscars. So she one-ups me there. All right. One other thing I want to talk about, a couple of local St. Louis events. We haven't talked about any local events the past couple of weeks. The Cinema St. Louis does the Classic French Film Festival, and they have announced their lineup, and some of our friends will be hosting and introducing these films. Army of Shadows is March 4th. March 5th is Elevator to the Gallows, and that'll be a 35mm print. That was Louis Malle's first film, and it's a film noir. And that'll be introduced by our friend Renee Hirschfeld. From Meyerling to Sarajevo will be introduced by our friend Robert Hunt. Hate is introduced by our colleague Calvin Wilson. That is Friday, March 11th. That's a good French film about skinhead gangs in France. La Cage aux Folles will be introduced by our We Are Movie Geeks contributor, Kate Marquis. That is Sunday, March 13th at 4 p.m. Diabolique, which is George Henry Clouzot's very terrifying 1960 French thriller starring Simone Signoret, is Friday, March 18th, and that will be introduced by our friend Kathy Corley. And Passion of Joan of Arc, Saturday, March 19th. I'm not sure who's introducing that one. Rififi, which is a great
caper film,
directed by Jules Dassin, and that will be introduced by our St. Louis Film Critics Association colleague, Diane Carson. Again, that is Sunday, March 20th at 7 p.m. So go to cinemastlouis.org to find out the details about this stuff, and maybe we'll talk about those a little bit more. I had an idea for the Classic French Film Festival that I submitted to Cliff Freilich, who is the director of Cinema St. Louis, and Cliff blew me off. My idea was to show René Clément's 1970 classic, Rider on the Rain, which is a really great movie. I guess the fact that it stars Charles Bronson was a deal killer for Cliff. That's my guess. But it's a great movie. It's one of these movies that Bronson made. You know, he went over to Europe in 68 to make Once Upon a Time in the West, which was a giant hit everywhere except the U.S. So he stayed in France, and he made a whole series of interesting films, including this one, Rider on the Rain, which he co-starred with Marlene Jobert, who was actually the mother of Eva Green, and his wife at the time. Jill Ireland is also in that film. So anyway, to make a long story short, Cliff had no interest in showing Rider on the Rain, but I own a 16mm print of Rider on the Rain, and actually it's a nice 16mm print. The color's really good on it. So I am going to show that at the Way Out Club on Tuesday, February 9th at 8 p.m. I'm going to show my 16mm print, and I'm teaming up with my buddy Roger from Roger's Reels. Roger, you may know, does the Three Stooges night, the second Monday of every month over at Schlafly. So we're going to start a new film series, and we're going to call it 16mm Double Feature Night. And Roger has an incredible collection of 16mm features. I have a few, and we have access to some other collections, so we could do this for a long, long time. But we're going to show Right Around the Rain at 8 o'clock, followed by Panic in Year Zero. Have you ever seen that, Jim?
That's familiar. Is that with Dana Andrews?
No. It's with Ray Milland. It's actually directed by Ray Milland. He plays, it's about the last, it's about a nuclear holocaust, and there's very few people left on Earth. So Ray Milland and his family, and his wife played by Gene Hagen, and his son is played by Frankie Avalon. And they go up into the mountains to get away from the nuclear fallout. And it's sort of a cross between an end of the world movie and a juvenile delinquent movies, because you got Richard Balkan, he was in a lot of those JD movies back in the 50s. So there's this whole gang of leather clad toughs that terrorize them as they're up in the mountains. It's a great movie, Panic in Year Zero. But Roger's got a great collection, so we'll be showing different double features. We'll try to team up like a genre film with maybe something fun. But he's got stuff like Dillinger with Warren Oates, and Capone with Ben Gazzara, and he's got The Entity with Barbara Hershey, and The 4D Man, and The Day the Earth Stood Still, and Billy Jack, and Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. He's got a great collection of like car chase movies and 70s schlock classics. And I've accessed, my friend Mike has The Mighty Peking Man and Godzilla vs. King Kong. So we'll be coming up with some pretty colorful double features to show at 16mm Double Feature Night at the Way Out Club, which is located at 2525 Jefferson. The first show, again, is February 9th, which is a Tuesday. But after that, we're going to do it on the first Tuesday of every month. So March 2nd will be the next one, and I'll talk about that a little more. We got a couple more minutes, guys. What do you want to talk about? You want to talk about this new Warcraft trailer?
It has begun. War is coming.
So why are you here?
To save our people.
We must fight together.
Can we trust him?
They're beasts. They should all be destroyed.
Are you sure about that?
We'll protect the kingdom. You and I.
We will try, my friend.
Warcraft, rated PG-13.
Yeah, there was a new one. Universal Pictures sent us. It was airing all day yesterday, but primarily during the championship football games. So, it is by Duncan Jones, who did Source Code and Moon son of David Bowie. It is a TV spot. I don't know if you both got to see. I know you had your reservations about, even the first trailer, that it looked more like a video game. Yeah. I mean, I'll give them props for taking on Warcraft. Such a popular game. So we'll see how it turns out. I'd be interested to see more video or more, just more everything from it. It's got a really good cast. Ben Foster, Paula Patton, Clancy Brown, Toby Kebbell, who did Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. So, Dr. Doom and Fantastic Four.
Thank you very much.
Can't go wrong with Clancy Brown.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's, going to be shown in 3D, real 3D, IMAX 3D, opens Friday, June 10th.
Yeah. As I say, this past Tuesday, also, we got our first look at the Wonder Woman film.
We did. Really?
They had a special on CW about Dawn of the Justice League. It was mostly a promo for the Suicide Squad and Batman versus Superman.
Is it the same actress that's in Batman versus Superman?
Yes,
Gal Gadot. So she's starring in her own standalone Wonder
Woman. Warner Brothers. Oh, yeah. And there's a Aquaman, and there's...
Yeah, Jason Momoa is Aquaman.
Yes.
They talk with the young man, I'm blanking on his name, who plays the Flash in Justice League. But the main interesting thing to me was seeing this this raw footage almost from the filming of the Wonder Woman film, and that's by Patty Jenkins, who did, I believe, Monsters was her film, right?
And this has
Chris Pine in it as Steve Trevor.
Interesting. Well, something to look forward to, and I guess the Batman versus Superman movie opens in March, and then when does the Wonder Woman movie open?
Probably next year.
Next year sometime. Yeah, all right.
And they also had, there's like three and four and five new TV spots for Batman versus Superman.
Okay. Well, we got to wrap this up, guys. unfortunately. It seems like we just started. Mm-hmm. So next week we'll be back and talk about more stuff, probably more Oscar stuff, because that's what we like to talk about. We can talk about maybe 50 Shades of Black if one of us sees it. Jane got a gun. I guess that's it. So let's wrap it up. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And listen again next week.
Black leather, black leather, ta ta ta. Black leather, black leather. Hello, darling. Hey, hey, hey. Black leather, black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, black leather, ta ta ta. Black leather, black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling, black leather rock. Black leather, black leather, smash, smash, smash. Black leather, crash, crash, crash. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling, black leather rock.
Forward in the battle, there, chaps.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. 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 I'm s